Greetings and salutations. Today, we have the pleasure of being joined by Richard D'Souza from the Vatican Observatory. He's both a Jesuit priest and an astronomer, and he studies galaxy formations and evolutions. After he completed his PhD in 2016 at the Max Planck Institute for Astrophysics and did a postdoc at Michigan, he joined the Vatican Observatory, where he still works today. We had the pleasure of talking to him about his somewhat unusual path as a scientist, his research, the role of God in the church in science, and much more. We really enjoy talking to Richard and hope that you all will enjoy listening.
Well, thanks for joining us today, Richard, on our podcast. Joe and I are really excited to talk to you about what you do at the Vatican and your role there, and also your research in astronomy. And we want to start off the conversation by talking a little bit about the astronomy kind of interest at the Vatican. And so when most people think of the Vatican, or they think of the relationship between religion and science, they often think back to their time in high school when they learned about the trials of Galileo back in the day. And then it's often a surprise, I think, to many, including myself, when I learned that there is an observatory that's funded and run by the Vatican. In Rome, and also that they hire several astronomers, including yourself. And so I was kind of hoping you could tell us what your role is at the Vatican and kind of what the motivation of the church was to start this kind of astronomy department.
Okay. So the church has always been interested in astronomy, right from even before the time of Galileo. So for the last 500 years, at least, the church has been interested in astronomy for a number of reasons. The first being that the heavens was always considered as something which was sacred and the place of God. It's the abode of God. So right from all cultures and religions in all cultures have a special place for astronomy. Astronomy plays a big role in all of them. But things happened to change about 500, 600 years ago, and then for a very practical reason. That's because of the expansion to the new worlds. And they are understanding now that they need to systematize how they fix the date of Easter. So generally the date, if you know any history about this, the date of Easter is generally fixed to the first one of the Sundays after the equinox, the first equinox, after the equinox. But there's some complicated algorithm to determine the date of Easter. But at least for the last, at least till the 1600s, it was actually decided on a year-to-year basis. So you could easily disperse that information out in Europe. But once the world started expanding, you really couldn't phone somebody up and say the date of Easter is going to be on this date. Because they were still following the old Julian calendar, and because of the problems with the Julian calendar, they were actually missing the date of Easter, was getting postponed day after day. So they really needed to fix it. So the change really happens about 500, 600 years back for practical reasons. The church has always been interested in astronomy. For practical reasons, they changed. And then they started actively hiring from that time astronomers to fix the calendar of the church. And that involved making very precise observations of the movement of the sun and to try and develop a system. And there was a Jesuit mathematician, Clavius, who used a system developed by an Italian and made it popular. And that's how we have the Gregorian calendar, which we follow till today. And since then, the church has always, in some form or the other, had a form of observatory and has hired astronomers. So right through the time of Galileo, even after Galileo, contemporaries with Galileo, there were people doing astronomy. So in this sense, the church has always been interested in astronomy. The Vatican Observatory, as we have it today, was founded in around 1903, 1905. The exact dates, I remember. It was founded by Pope Leo the 13th, if I remember right. And it was because the Vatican itself, as a state, was founded around that time. So it's connected with Italian history. There was a reunification of Italy. The Italians took over all the former territories of the Pope, took away his old observatories, which now became Italian observatories. And then the Pope was left without an observatory. And thus this being an intellectual Pope, he wanted an observatory. He founded an observatory. And the Vatican Observatory today is really that observatory which continues from that period. So the founding of the Vatican Observatory today is really an interest of the church always in astronomy. But its real reason why it was founded was a political reason, because of the Italian state taking away the old observatories of the Pope.
And so nowadays, most people, when they think of astronomers, you know, think of people in universities or people at these huge observing telescopes, and they probably don't think that there could exist an observatory affiliated with or a part of the Vatican. Is the Vatican Observatory different than any other modern day university observatory or observatory otherwise, or is it just really exactly the same thing, it's just run by someone else?
I would say there are many similarities, but there is some important differences. So let's start with the similarities. The similarities are easy. We are a small observatory. We are about like 15 people. We don't have a big staff, but our main job is to do scientific research, like in any observatory. We have historical telescopes right from the early 20th century. We continue to have a modern 2 meter class telescope at Arizona. So like any other observatory, our main job is scientific research.
Yeah.
The difference is that when Pope Leo XIII founded the observatory, he was founding it at a time of what is called as the modernistic crisis. And this is, you all are familiar with it, but you all probably don't know it by its name. It's the crisis, which means that, you know, the church is something old, ancient, and rejects modern ideas and thoughts. There was this very strong tendency within the Catholic Church during that epoch, but also it was a dominant view of everyone else. So he also entrusts to the observatory, in addition to its scientific duties, to do something twofold. He says your mission is to do science, but then your mission is to show the church, the faithful of the church and the world, that science and religion go together. Yeah. So we have this twofold duty of moving inwards, actually telling Catholics, telling Christians that science and religion go together, but also going outwards towards other scientists and saying science and religion go together. So we have these additional duties, as I would say, in addition to the normal scientific duty. They're not, today, I think all observatories have public outreach. It is becoming an increasing part of modern day observatories and modern day astronomy departments. We have always had that embedded in our mission for the last 100 years.
Yeah. And
I was going to say that, you know, you mentioned that the purpose of kind of the observatory is to demonstrate that science and religion go together. Although with that, I think there's a lot of historical tensions between science and religion. And so if you were to ask me, you know, how would I define religion, I may include the words of faith or belief or something like along those lines. Whereas if you were to ask me to define science, I would say, you know, you need evidence and like data upon data in order to possibly show that something is true or prove that it's possibly correct. And so How do you kind of reconcile or balance those two different communities that you're within as a scientist and as an astronomer?
So I actually start off by, when I talk to astronomers and I talk to fellow scientists, I'm actually quite hard at them, because they actually very, it's my impression that they little understand their own trade. They don't understand the science they do. I personally believe that there is a lot of faith and a lot of belief in the sciences, especially in astronomy, where we know so little. I like to point out that, you know, there are so many dimensions of faith which we take off in astronomy as well. Starting from, you know, the theories which we ourselves don't prove, but we accept the authority of others. Starting with the various models which we use continuously until somebody chucks them out. Starting to, you know, to the way we even apply for funds and, you know, the faith that we have in each other to solve certain problems. I think it is, it's a misconstruction of the sciences to say that there is no faith in the sciences. There is no dimension of faith. It's not the same as the faith in religion. In religion, faith is more in a person, in a relationship. Well, the element of faith is in all human dimensions, political, social, but also science being an integral part of it. So I think there is an element of faith in the sciences. I would like to point out that in certain sense, sciences don't always work on observations. Observations are an integral part of the sciences, but it's much more also that there's a lot of extrapolation from the models we have. I'd like to go back to the, since you all mentioned Galileo and you talked about the trials of Galileo, I'd like to point out that most people never really understand the problem. Most scientists also, most astronomers don't really understand the problems which were at the time of Galileo and the church and the astronomers of the church. Let's take it for a simple reason. Galileo proposed this theory that the Earth goes around the sun. Now, it's not a new theory. It was discussed at the time of the Greeks 2000 years ago, and they rejected it. And they rejected it for good reason, because they realized that if the Earth goes around the sun, you should see that the stars would have motions. There would be proper motions in the stars. This was an objection 2000 years ago. So when Galileo actually came around the scene and he saw the theories of Copernicus, and then he, using his observations of Jupiter and Saturn, and saw the moons around the Jupiter and Saturn, he realized one thing. He conceptualized the idea that the Earth is not the center of the universe. This is what he conceptualized. But he had really no definite proof. And what the other observers of that period, who were actually, you know, I would call hardcore observers, and who wanted that proof, didn't find it. So the first detection of proper motion was by Edward Halley, I think so, in 1781 or 17, in the 18th century.
Yeah.
So the first proof as we have it of Galileo's, the real proof, which we would accept today in hindsight, came about 150 years later. So I don't know if you all are familiar with philosophy, but there are these two conceptual ideas of Plato and Aristotle. Plato had this conceptual idea that, you know, the world here is only a mirror of a perfect world out there. So he lived in the world of ideas. And Aristotle was, I want evidence. This is the so in a sense, scientists tend to be Aristotelian, right? We want the hard evidence. But actually, if you look at the time of Galileo, Galileo was not Aristotelian. He was Platonic. Mm. He was on the level of ideas. He was so convinced of his idea, and it was right. I mean, he was a genius. He could see into the future. But the guys who really were the Aristotelians and really wanted the proof didn't find it. And that led to serious tensions between Galileo and the church. And then it spilled over to interpretation of the Bible. I like to just to make this, bring it home a bit. I like to say, that's today we are talking about science, and we have these theories of string theory, right? Mm. You must have heard of string theory and these exotic things, right? And many of us as astronomers, we would dismiss them saying, there's no proof. Mm. There's no proof, there's no scientific proof, right? So if we were to have this conversation like Galileo and his opponents at that time, it would be like Galileo would be saying, I believe in string theory, like an Edward Vision. I believe in string theory. And we'll be like, it's nothing. I mean, it's stupid. You don't have proof. What are you talking about? So you see, the tensions of that time are very different from what we learn as a very simplified story when we were in school. It's much more complicated than that. And it has implications right till today.
Yeah. And I mean, even modern astronomy and some of its key sort of ideas someone came up with them when he was in the shower or looking in the mirror or something like that. I mean, dark matter, I think someone looked at some rotation curves and thought, oh, wow, that's interesting. Let me invent something new and say that there's five times more of it than there is of everything else. Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. We are platonic in that sense. Yeah. We believe in dark matter.
And I mean, it is a very interesting idea that many people try to think of science as being this evidence-driven thing. But to my knowledge, a huge amount of our modern discoveries were made by someone thinking of something crazy first and then someone else confirming it,
which is many years later.
Yeah,
often many years.
I think the most recent example of that would be, 1915 with Einstein's GR, and humans sat not knowing if gravitational waves existed or if, that theory was right for 100 years until just the past few years in 2015 when they discovered LIGO.
I mean, I don't want to negate negate observations and negate the fact of this, but I think we should have a more realistic perspective of what exactly we are doing in our sciences, right? I mean, I spent a couple of years studying philosophy of science, so I have examined these issues. Unfortunately, in our coursework on science, for any science graduate, any scientist, they spend hardly any time trying to understand the rich field of philosophy of science, which grapples with these issues. But we as practicing scientists never really have a time to think about,
And we also wanted to talk to you about what it is that you study as an astronomer, because when you were at Michigan, you worked with the same professor with whom Michael does research as well, who's Michael's undergrad mentor. And so we wanted to talk to you about what it is exactly that you're researching.
Okay. So what I study is I try and my focus of my research today has been to try and decipher the histories of galaxies, the accretion histories of galaxies. So that's what I started off with my PhD, and I've continued ever since. But the focus has become now a bit more particular. The question has become much more focused. So in particular, I look at galaxies which look like the Milky Way, which is something which I started doing with Eric, basically, with Professor Eric, and was trying to say, okay, let's ask the specific question. If you look at a particular galaxy, can we say something about what is its history? What fell in? What is the biggest galaxy it ate for dinner? That would be my type of question, which I typically ask. When I was at Michigan, Eric posed me this question. He says, there are thousands of galaxies which fall in. you know, into a Milky Way-like galaxy, smaller ones. Let's forget about the rest. Let's concentrate on the biggest guy that fed it. And that was his insight, which drove us to do a lot of research together, basically with large-scale simulations of Milky Way mass galaxies. And we came up with a very original theory, an idea of how we can actually decipher, you know, based on the observation which Eric does in his team, is to look by looking at those observations of the halos of galaxies, the stellar halos of galaxies, to decipher what fell in into that galaxy. What is the biggest thing which the galaxy ate for dinner? So that has been my focus for a number of years. And over the last 2 years, I have slightly changed that focus. And I have moved now to trying to understand the satellite populations of galaxies, given the knowledge which we have of what fell in into these galaxies. So the idea being is that, just to give you a concrete example, take the Milky Way. We know that the LMC is falling in right now into the Milky Way. We also know that the LMC has its own satellites and is bringing in satellites into the Milky Way. So if you would consider that the Milky Way had a number of these large things falling in, so we know it's the LMC. There was another one called Gaia and Enceladus about 10 billion years ago. And we know both of them brought in large numbers of satellites. Does knowledge of these accretions, these big things coming in, tell us something about the satellite populations or inverting that question also? Looking at the satellite populations, can we learn something about the big accretion which fell in? This is the kind of slight diversion I've taken since I've left Michigan. I continue working with Eric a lot. So this is to answer the basic question, I'm trying to find out what the biggest galaxy, what your galaxy ate for dinner, that would be.
Yeah.
One question I have related to that is, you mentioned looking for the largest progenitors, so the largest galaxies that collided with the galaxy we see in the present day. What about kind of the desserts? You said mentioned you're looking for what it ate for dinner, but what about all the little desserts, for example? What would those tell you additional information, or is it really the largest progenitor that tells you about the history of that galaxy you're looking at?
No, so, well, definitely the history includes the big thing which you ate and the small and the smaller galaxies which you ate. And the assumption which we are going by is that the biggest thing causes the most damage to the galaxy itself. Mm-hmm. So that's what we are interested in, the biggest thing. So think of it, I like to give to point out that, you know, you think of a brand new car and you see these bumps and dents on the car and you realize, wait a second, this is a new car, but something has hit it. Somebody has scratched it. There's something big hits it, you really see a big bump, right? So the bigger it is, the bigger damage it does to the galaxy in terms of changing its properties. So the more basic question behind looking at the accretion is to say, how do these mergers change galaxy properties? Yeah. So in that sense, then we're really looking for the big guys, which came in.
Okay.
That is a really central question in galaxy formation, is how do mergers change galaxies? Is it in situ properties? Is it just as it is? Mm-hmm. Or is it really something outside coming in which changes it? So it's probably a mixture of both, but you need to disentangle those issues. And one of this way is to identify the mergers, the big mergers of all these galaxies. And I'm getting a bit more into the technical details, but this is the basic question. How do mergers affect galaxies? And we're going with the assumption that the bigger the merger is, the more the change to the galaxy is.
And one thing that we were talking about earlier with Galileo is, you know, he discovered that Earth wasn't unique and that Earth wasn't, you know, the center of the universe. And I imagine that the Milky Way is not unique and the Milky Way is not the center, as we know, not the center of the universe. And so you mentioned that you're looking at Milky Way mass galaxies. Have we found that you know, most galaxies undergo large mergers in the past? Is the Milky Way unique where it hasn't undergone a large merger?
So you're right. You know, there is a sort of this idea that we are the center of the universe, and we kind of, because we can observe the Milky Way the most, we can study it really well, we kind of think that that is the blueprint of how every other galaxy should be like. So in fact, I actually don't study the Milky Way. I find it to be a very crowded field because there are a lot of people studying the Milky Way. And especially with Gaia today, which is this new satellite which has these proper motions of every practical star within 5 kiloparsecs of us, the number of people working in the Milky Way science is just tremendous, right? So the science which I actually do is to look at galaxies nearby which look like the Milky Way, to give you some insight into, you know, what's the range you can find. One of the key insights which we actually found with Eric was, if we look at the Milky Way and we compare with every other galaxies about the similar size, you actually see that the Milky Way had a very average or even below average merger history. Andromeda ate a giant a couple of years ago. That was our research on Andromeda. And all the other galaxies were a bit more than the Milky Way, but the Milky Way had a really quiet history, ate something up very early in its history, and it's going to eat something now, the LMC. But on the whole, it has been a rather quiet history in comparison with other galaxies. It may look big if you're looking at the Milky Way alone, but in comparison with other galaxies, it's peeny weeny. So I think that this other insight which I'm getting from, which I've actually borrowed from Eric here, is that, you know, it's looking at outside and comparing how you are with the outside, that you get a better perspective of your place in the universe, of our place in the universe. Mm. And that is the basic insight that we are doing now, is studying other Milky Way mass galaxies and hoping that information will feed back to help people who are studying the Milky Way to put their knowledge into perspective.
And so when you talk about looking at a galaxy to find its history, are you mostly focusing on looking at just a couple of galaxies and trying to analyze what's going on within each of them in a great amount of detail? Or are you maybe trying to look at many, many more galaxies and trying to see if you can pick out patterns throughout all of them?
Okay, so I started off by studying many galaxies, the average properties of many galaxies. That's how I started off my PhD research. So I took thousands and thousands of Milky Way mass galaxies from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey and use that information from that survey to study their halo properties, their stellar halo properties, and to try to get an average profile of it. However, working with Eric, his focus is now on nearby galaxies. So there are not many nearby. So we are looking at stars, galaxies that we can resolve their stars with the Hubble Space Telescope. And basically you can only resolve them to maybe by not overspending your time on the Hubble, right? Within one orbit of the Hubble, you can basically resolve stars out to 10 megaparsecs. So that's think of our distance to Andromeda is about 0.8 of a megaparsec. So think of, you know, 10 times that distance is what you can resolve with one orbit of Hubble Space Telescope. So the number of galaxies which look like the Milky Way is basically 10 to 15 in that group. So the sample size which we are studying is 10 to 15. In reality, what we are tending to do is now looking at really 1 or 3 or 4 or 5 and working on individual history. So I've kind of moved to be the more particular, from the general to the particular.
And so would it be a fair description to say that you're now a forensic investigator of each galaxies, and you're in the same way that in movies we see people trying to find who done it, you are trying to...
I call myself a galactic archaeologist. So you know, I don't want to call, don't want to call myself an Indiana Jones, put on the hat, but you know, it is basically galactic archaeology. You're trying to discover, rediscover a galaxy's history.
Mm-hmm. And you know? so given that, what are the biggest open questions now in your field? What are the most current problems that people are trying to find answers to?
Yeah, so one of the big questions in our field is what does a galaxy merger do to a galaxy? That is a central question which we have been trying to answer for the last few years. And in reality, we're kind of grappling with the answer now is that in reality, it doesn't seem much. It doesn't seem really much. So there's not many much changes that mergers do to galaxies. But we really don't know. And so that still remains a very big question. The other question, which we have at the moment, which I'm really trying to grapple my head with, is to try and understand the satellite populations of Milky Way mass galaxies. And this is a big field, which I'm not in, which I haven't really published much in, but it's something I'm moving to. But my interest in this is to say, okay, I have been studying the stellar halo. So let me just put things in perspective for every of the people who will be looking at this podcast. What is a stellar halo? A stellar halo is, think of a galaxy, and a galaxy is eating up another galaxy around it. And this galaxy is now, as it's coming in, it's getting destroyed by the various gravitational tidal forces and is dispersed into stars. So individual stars, it's just ripped apart. And all these stars now are floating around the galaxy, around the main galaxy, which ate the smaller galaxy. And what I have been trying to do in the past is now look at these individual stars in the halo and try and decipher its history. And the best example I could give this in my public talks is, I like to say, to give the example of a parent, you know, parents trying to help feed a small child, you know. So there's this mother who entrusts the small one-year-old or two-year-old to the dad and says, today, you feed the child, right? And so the dad feeds the child, and then he goes out for a minute and he goes to the toilet, and then the mom returns back, and the mom is now trying to understand, what did the child eat for dinner? What did the father feed him? And the best thing she can do is look at the flow and see all the crumbs. And then she would say, oh, the child ate broccoli today because there's broccoli on the floor and there's bread over the floor. So you kind of look around and she is trying to reconstruct the past. So this is the kind of thing, the stellar halo, this extended field of stars surrounding the galaxy, which got there by the shredding of another galaxy. And basically I'm trying to reconstruct the past. Now, what I am looking at, so this is the one way of reconstructing the past. You could think of another way of reconstructing the past is every time something comes in, it brings in all these small galaxies with it. And some of these small galaxies, because they are very small and the friction doesn't really make them disrupt because they are very small, dynamical friction works on size, they kind of survive till the present day. So you could actually look at the galaxy, the satellite population, and then say, which of these things could have come from that, from the guy who came in? So you're trying to decipher. That's a much more harder problem to do, but it's another tracer. So you're kind of looking at various tracers of the past. Then you could think of a third different way, which I'm not in, is look at the globular clusters. So, you know, the Milky Way has a set of globular clusters. You could imagine that the LMC has the globular clusters. And one day the LMC's globular clusters will become part of the Milky Way's globular clusters. And then maybe 5 or 6 billion years in the future, somebody will be looking back and saying, these are the globular clusters of the Milky Way today. What can I discover could have fallen in? You know, you kind of do this kind of various tricks. So they're all like little parts of a puzzle The best way you can think of it is this, you know, these blind men trying to decipher an elephant. One of them touches the trunk. One of them touches the leg. And you're all trying to reconstruct the past. And pretty much what we're doing are projections. A lot of faith going into our models. We like to believe our models because we made them. And this is what we try and do to reconstruct the past.
Yeah. That's really fascinating. And I may be biased a bit because I also do work with Eric. And also what I find most interesting is how by studying these galaxies outside the local group, you're able to contextualize the Milky Way. Because as you mentioned, you know, with Gaia, and as you said, a disproportional amount of astronomers working with the Milky Way, it seems that our galaxy formation models are quite skewed towards where everyone's working, which is the Milky Way. And so it's glad to know that like you're kind of, in a sense, steering them back in the direction galaxy formation models should go.
Think of this like, at the time of Galileo and everyone else, it's like Galileo is pointing them, hey, you know, you're not right. You know, you're not the center of the universe. There's something else there, out there. Look a bit out there, right?
Yeah. And I think one question that Joe and I had was exactly how you got into astronomy. And so, you know, we may have not mentioned it formally yet, but you are a Jesuit priest through the Vatican, as well as an astronomer. And so was astronomy something that you always wanted to do in your early life? Or was there a certain moment where you realized that you want to pursue it in your future as a career?
So it may be disappointing to you guys, but actually I never dreamt of being an astronomer all my life. I mean, when I was young, I had no dreams of being an astronomer. I was always interested in science, always interested in engineering type problems. I was always interested in basic physics and things like that. But astronomy was a bit out there. Like, you know, when I was small, I loved physics because you could take physics or a physical object and you could touch it and you could, you know, put pressure on it and see how it deformed. With astronomy, you just have to wait for its photons to reach you, and that's it. I mean, you can't touch it, right? So I was very much interested in physics, in basic physics. But I also belong to the Jesuit order, and in the Jesuit order, we actually work on the basis of obedience, which means basically your superiors mission you to do a particular job which they would like you to do. So they came up to me and said, you know, we have this observatory, we need to staff it. You're interested in physics. Astronomy and physics is, you know, not too much of a difference. Would you be interested in working in astronomy? I mean, in the beginning, I was not at all too keen. But as I looked around, I realized, you know, there are a lot of the things which I learned in physics, in basic physics, which I could actually apply very well to astronomy, astrophysics. And so I'm quite happy leaving the observations to somebody else and sitting back and spending my time trying to understand those observations, trying to decipher them, trying to give meaning to them, and try to help forward with the science. And I've kind of found this niche, which I enjoy doing. And that's how I ended up in science. So basically it was also a little push externally from the Jesuit Superior, the Jesuit Order, who needed to find astronomers to run the observatory, and this is how it is.
And we thought as well that it's, I mean, because part of our idea or part of the motivation behind starting this podcast was to show that there really are a huge number of different ways that people end up getting into science, and that it's not only broad in terms of the actual different stuff that people study, which is very broad in and of itself, but also there's a wide variety of different people who start studying it. When you set out, did people think that was an unusual path? Did people around you, you know, give you some kickback on going to become an astronomer, or was it just smooth sailing the whole way?
I would say that I did not have much opposition. I think it wasn't smooth sailing.
Yeah.
But I didn't have much opposition. I mean, my my family, the culture which I come from, didn't understand it. But there wasn't a serious opposition in terms of, you know, I mean, at the most, the question was, why are you studying so much? Get a job, you know, something like that. But there wasn't any serious opposition. I think the biggest difficulty was the number of breaks I took, you know, between getting my degrees, getting my doctorate. Where I had to study other stuff, like philosophy, theology. I even worked for a little bit of a while. That was the more difficult part in getting back, you know, after you have not done science for 8 years and then you suddenly get back into it. There was a bit of inertia to get over, trying to remember your differential equations.
Yeah. Did you study philosophy because you had to or because you wanted to in the middle?
It was both. I would say I had to, because to become a Jesuit priest, everyone needs to study philosophy. And I was very much interested in it because I had just finished my master's in physics, astronomy. And I had all these questions. And, you know, taking a break, going for philosophy was just the right period to ask. So like I actually went into studying philosophy having a background in science. Yeah. So I spent my time in philosophy trying to say, okay, now what are we doing there in science? And is it really as we scientists think we are doing? And what is the perspectives of philosophers of science?
And I mean, that is, I think I can speak safely for a lot of people who are studying physics or astronomy or math like me. A lot of people are somewhat disappointed that, or not disappointed, but feel that they're missing out on a lot of the philosophical aspects of science. Because when you're studying formal courses in science, they teach you differential equations and stuff, but that doesn't always answer the big questions or where these ideas come from or how they all fit together, which I think would have been interesting to learn as well.
Yeah. Yes, I agree. I mean, you can imagine there's already so much to study in physics and astronomy. I mean, you know, to insert in coursework on philosophy, additionally, which is like a full field in itself, would be a whole, it'd be difficult. I wouldn't know how you would be able to do it. But I mean, in a sense also, but at least in the American system, which you guys have a more liberal arts education system, you will have that opportunity of taking a few other courses,
yeah,
which would help you broaden. I mean, my undergraduate, which was done in India, was pure science. It was like, there wasn't a liberal arts course at all.
Yeah, for sure. If I only had classes that were only science, I think it would be much harder to get through the semester. We when Michael and I were thinking of talking to you as well, obviously you were in the Jesuit order and a scientist. And so we're thinking, well, that's really interesting because you hear a lot nowadays about the science and religion debate. Mm-hmm. And you hear people saying, oh, and you hear a number of very eminent scientists say, you know, I have no room for religion. I believe in the facts or whatever. And I think it comes as a surprise even to many people that, for example, one of the pioneers of the idea of the Big Bang, Lemaître, was a Belgian Jesuit as well. And
Belgian Catholic priest, not a Jesuit.
Oh, okay. He was a Belgian Catholic priest. And, you know, it's interesting when you hear that people talk about how the Big Bang and the idea of creation with, with God, as in the book of Genesis, you know, who created the earth, like it says in the Bible. And apparently, from what I read, Lemaître was actually displeased when the Pope at the time saw his discovery and said, oh, this is a really good thing because your discovery allows there to be room for a creator. There exists room for God and religion to be compatible. Are these questions that you is trying to reconcile science with religious ideas like we've had them either in the Bible or nowadays, is that something that's part of your daily or weekly job, is that something you think about, or is that something that you think is
from? So, yes, well, let's put it this way. I mean, I can talk for hours on this because there's so much to start off with. Let me start off by saying that these are some of the questions we have at the back of our heads, and I have very kind of fixed answers for them because I've kind of sorted these issues out, as you can imagine, for myself. So my understanding of religion is basically, I look towards a, both a mature understanding of the sciences, which we talked about, you know, just a bit, but also a very mature understanding of religion, which unfortunately at times people often tend to take a caricature of religion as you can take a caricature of sciences. And the problem is there's so much of stupidity floating around in religions, you know, with people not really understanding their own religious traditions. Like as we scientists don't understand our own scientific tradition and its history. There's so much of, I mean, like, so I counsel scientists to go study your history, to know how things came about. But I also tell people, religious people, you know, go study your history, go study your sources. So the Catholic Church has a very open understanding of scripture. And it's never really been taken into a very, it's not taken a very rigid form. So there's the, at least the Catholic understanding of the observatory is not to go and say, go prove the Bible.
Yeah.
We understand, we are mature enough today to see and understand that the Bible is written in various genres and is not to be taken as literally. There are genres where it reports history. There is genre where there is myth, as in the books of Genesis, but the myth to give you morals and stories. Like, think of the Aesop fables. It has truths.
Yeah.
Right? But it, I mean, we know it's true, but we're not going to say that the tortoise and the rabbit actually ran the race together. We know the truth. So there are various genres in the Bibles, and we understand what those genres are. And it's going to a very deep understanding of scripture. So this is one thing. So I like to point out that, so starting off with that, objective in the sciences to reconcile faith and science is not to get an easy fix where we try and make sure that things are, it's a very profound cohesion. And my basic philosophy, and many of us here working in the observatory, is basically, it's our fundamental belief now that God created the universe, okay, and he created the universe good. That's at least that was the, even the book of Genesis says he created the good. Now, if he created the world good, it's a studying the universe would be a pleasure because it would only tell you about how good the creator was.
Yeah.
And that's a joy. So for me, like doing science is like worshiping God because that is, I mean, I'm actually finding out all the intricate, crazy ways and the beautiful, you know, mysterious, not simple ways in which the world works.
Yeah.
You mentioned that when the Pope began the church, part of it was to demonstrate that when the Pope started astronomy within the Vatican and the church, that part of the reason was to kind of demonstrate that, you know, the church is in a sense modern and with science or can do science. Because you mentioned it seems like the church history is strictly with astronomy and not other disciplines of science. And so is that just because, you know, astronomy is kind of the study of the heavens and kind of seeing the creation of God out there? Was that part of the reason for the
Vatican? Let's talk about this. This is interesting. So I like to point out that, you know, let's go back to a more philosophical understanding. Excuse the philosophy, but I'll try and make it very simple. So our understanding of the human person is that a human person is transcendental. What does this mean? In comparison to other animals, we can think about the future. We can project, we can think about the heavens. We can, you know, plan in the future. We can think about the past. We can transcend our immediacy, right?
Yeah.
So this is the basic understanding of the human person. It's across all cultures. Many religions hold this view that, you know, that we are this very transcendental dimension. So There is a natural attraction within the human person for something transcendental. We cannot deny it. So if you look at a beautiful painting, you look at a beautiful art, you look at the night sky, they're all transcendent. It's beyond, takes you there. The best way I like to think of it is the beautiful picture of Michelangelo on the Sistine Chapel between God and Adam. You know, there's two, you know that famous picture. In a certain sense, what Michelangelo conceptualized was God creating the man in his image and likeness. However, but it was also showing you this very, in his own way, this very transcendental dimension of man reaching out to the beyond, you know, in his reaching out to the beyond. So I'd like to point out to this, what he's trying to show you is man's transcendence. Now think of it this way. Everything we do, all work we do, any plan, anything you're good at, is all forms of transcendence, right? Now think of it, the thing which is most transcendental and most physical will be astronomy. Because it's really out there. So therefore, for centuries, astronomy has always fascinated humankind. All cultures, from the Mayans, the Indians, the Egyptians, all looked up and that's good. Even the, I have to give this example. If you do public outreach, right? You take a telescope, you go to Africa, you go to kids in India. I've lived in the desert in Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. Go anywhere. Take a kid, take a Michigan University professor, show them the telescope, show them the moons of Jupiter and Saturn, and every one of them will go, wow. Yeah. Something lights up in them. Because that's the human transcendence which Michelangelo was trying to point out to. So that's why astronomy is the queen of the sciences, right? That's also why astronomy was the first science department at the University of Michigan.
Yeah,
I mean, if you study the history of the University of Michigan, it was the first science department. It has always been the queen of sciences, right from the time of Aristotle, you know, Plato, right up till the present day. So I'd like to point out then the most transcendental thing you could be would be the divine, would be in my... So there is a very close connection between religion and astronomy, but not just because, you know, that's the place where God lives. It's really something much more deeper. And that's the understanding of transcendence, that is the understanding of the human person. So that's why there's always been that link. So the Pope, 100 years ago, when he founded the present Vatican Observatory, was continuing in that tradition because he had a bunch of observatories which were right from the time of Galileo, were taken away from him. But then because of the circumstances of that time, which became anti-clerical, anti-church, and you know, the church history was not very innocent. So I'm not trying to excuse the church in any way. But he realized he needed an opening within the church too. You know, there was a certain sort of, when people are under attack, they tend to close up and then they you know, everything yeah. outside is bad. And he needed to open that out. And so his mission was also not primarily to the scientists, but to show the church itself that in its long history, it has always been open to the sciences. Think of Mendel, the theory of genetic. Think of all the science, all the astronomy discoveries, the moons and the craters on the moon. There are about 35 Jesuits' names there on the craters of the moon. So many things which over time. Or the first person to actually discover the classified stars was a Jesuit priest, Angelo Secchi. And he did it even before the people at Harvard did it with their classification scheme. And he actually showed how you can decipher the elements in the stars. So there's this long history. But I want to go back to that story of Lemaître because you braided it up. And perhaps a bit of understanding goes well here. So there is this constant fight in philosophy in the sciences, and the sciences reflect philosophy, about whether the world was created by God, or it existed from infinity. So the church has got, the church and various religions held on to the view that God created the universe and God created the world. So in their perspective, the most natural consequence would be a start.
Yeah.
And then you continue. Well, the atheists, those who did not believe in God, would prefer the view, the scientific view, that the world was continuous, steady. So the grand proponent of the steady state theory was Fred Hoyle. And Fred Hoyle was an open atheist. Like, he was vehement about it. And he held on against evidence because he believed that the world could not have a start. Because if the world had a start, then there is space for a creator.
Yeah.
So this was this eternal fight between this, you know, thing. This is a very simplistic fight, which unfortunately even continued right to our present day. Stephen Hawking always wanted to prove that the Big Bang never existed. So he wanted to show that this eternal return. He went out of his theories of doing that, partly because he's guided by that philosophy. But going back to the story of Lemaître, what Lemaître understood when he came up with his theory of the Big Bang, the primordial, he called it the primordial crash or something. He didn't actually use the word the Big Bang. But in his system of view, which he, when you look at Einstein's equation, Einstein wanted a more steady state theory. And he showed, no, your own equations are compatible with an expansion if you put it in the cosmological constant. He proposed an understanding, which, you know, the world started from scratch. And the Pope, of course, understanding the start, steady state, you know, start latched onto it because it was like a hope for him that, you know, oh, you know, there's space for God. But what Lemaître, in his wisdom, understood that you cannot really, if you really understand science is something which changes every 20, 30 years. Yeah. I mean, we don't, I could be certain that 30 years from now, people are going to say what Richard D'Souza discovered was wrong, and in reality was this. We are sure about that. There's one thing certain about the science, is going to change, right? So Lemaître really understood this because he was a scientist. And he realized you couldn't base, you know, you try to base a proof of God's existence on science because science continuously changes. And then if you do that, then 30 years from now, your proof falls. Yeah. That was the kind of his displeasure at the Pope was for that reason, because he understood science. He managed to convince the Pope of not making a public utterance, not making a public speech in which he did. Yeah. Anyway, that's the story of Lemaître. I couldn't resist giving you a bit of historical insight.
And you mentioned before, when you were talking about Fred Hoyle, how he was an open atheist. And it seemed like, yeah, at least in the story that you told, it seemed like that his religion, in a sense, dictated the science he did, or at least he tried to kind of justify it, and maybe in the back of his mind, in his personal life, try to justify the science he was doing with his religion, or a lack of religion. And so I was kind of wondering this, we've mentioned Galileo a few times, but there's a quote from him that goes, "The Bible tells you how to go up to heaven, not how the heavens go." And I'm sure maybe you've heard that before. And I was wondering should scientists bring their religion into their quote unquote scientific lab? Like, in your case, that may be an observatory, or that may be working in your, you know, Python Jupyter notebook with the data. Is there a room for religion in the science lab? How do you separate the two?
So first of all, the quote which you is actually not from Galileo. It's actually from Cardinal Bellarmino, who was a contemporary of Galileo and was a Jesuit priest who was involved in the trials of Galileo and was trying to help Galileo a lot to save him from... Galileo had a lot of enemies. He never made friends. And he had a way of exciting enemies, you know, latching on. His most famous fights with the Jesuits were about who discovered the moons of Jupiter first, and citations about who discovered sunspots first. But that's another story. But I find it difficult. So when I enter the lab, when I enter my lab space, being like working with data, I have to admit, religion often never enters in. It shapes my view, but it never enters in explicitly. Maybe often what does happen, I kind of, in hindsight, reflect about it. And you know, in the moment, it's about a problem at hand, and it's like my full mental powers are trying to solve that particular problem. So religion doesn't enter too much for me personally in the day-to-day problems at hand. It shapes my views, I have to admit. And I think it shapes everyone's views. Nobody comes into science with a clean slate. Everybody comes in with an ideology. We talked about Fred Hoyle. We can talk about many others who entered the sciences to improving people's situations. You know, people who had, I basically know people, many biologists who entered into the sciences because some of their relatives had diseases which, you know, are incurable, and they were like, I need to find that cure. There's so many of these exigencies which enter into our motivations for doing science. There could be so many of them. And then some of us, and there's always the fun in doing science, no doubt about that, and discovering something new. But a lot of our science is never a clean slate. We always come with our baggage into the sciences. Unfortunately, but that is how it is.
One of the things...
Go ahead. Sorry.
Thank you. One of the things that I've always found really fascinating about the religion, the relationship between astronomy and God, is that every time that someone seems to make a discovery and that would somehow implicate God or not, we seem to be pushing back where God is hiding in the heavens. So back in the days when our understanding of space was limited to a couple of stars and our sun, people seem to think that God was right there. And so maybe, you know, I assume that scientists back then would have thought, oh, you know, if there is room for a God, then he would be doing all of these things. And now that we understand the universe a lot better than we used to, and we understand how things move and things like that, it seems that, oh, if God is somewhere doing something, it's, you know, through the Big Bang or in different universes, or he exists somewhere radically different. And so the influence of God never really seems to be coming into the science that people are doing. I don't know if that's a correct analysis on my part. What do you think about something like that?
So I don't think it's in that form. I think that's a very naive way of looking at it. So God is both, the concept, religions consider God as both transcendent, that's what you mean out there, and they're trying to push that caveat, but he's also immanent. So that's both, all religions talk about the transcendence of God and the immanence of God.
Right.
It's a concept which is both, you know, it's neither here nor there, right? So, yeah. And I think it's a very it's very simplest to talk about location, right?
Right.
And that would be like, you know, I like to point out, like, that's like a 5-year-old talking about God. But unfortunately, most people think about religion, they learn it till they are 5 or 6 years old, and it's that steady state, you know, which they don't really grow in the knowledge of what religion. It's a very simplistic understanding of religion, you know. But it's both so transcendence as well as immanence, and it depends on what you focus. But transcendence is not a physical location.
Yeah,
and that's what we also need to understand. It's not a physical location. Right? I mean, For people who, this very simplistic understanding of, you know, the more you improve in science, the more you're displacing God, is too simplistic. It's not what religions teach. I would say this partly for all religions. They do not talk about God as a vocation. I think that's the best kind of response I could.
That makes a lot of sense.
And in philosophy, there's often philosophers come up with the physical universe and the spiritual universe, and they kind of, at least nowadays, they're trying to explain, for example, in consciousness, you know, can we explain everything with science? And so what are kind of your views as to, you know, what are the limitations of science, and how far can we bring science to explain everything around us?
So that's an interesting set of words you use. Science to explain everything around us. That's like a theory of everything. That's always been the wish of science. Mm-hmm.
Is there an aspect to the universe that we live in that we just can't, that's not tangible with science?
I like to put it this way. Let's start with our own human experience. Our human experience is very complicated. And science is very young. Let's be frank. In the scheme of things, science is very young, right? So we are discovering things by leaps and bounds, and things are changing, but science is very young. There are many things in science which we know very well, like the laws of physics, the laws in chemistry. Biology, things are becoming a bit wishy-washy already. You know, we have many unknowns. We think we know a lot, but still we are discovering a lot more. Then with more complicated systems, things get very complicated. Think of the environment. You know, it's a multi-dimensional, even astronomy, we know very little, to be honest. Let's be frank about this, right? So, but then there's this full aspect of many aspects of human dimension, relationships, you know, how a society behaves, which science has no answers yet. I'm not saying it will never have an answer, but it has no answers yet. It has been in the past that people, that there's something which Gadamer complained about, is that when we talk about, so everything is a science today, right? We talk about the human sciences, we talk about the social sciences, and we talk about the physical sciences. But let's now, but there was a big, because the physical sciences were so very successful, he felt that the social sciences and the human sciences were actually trying to copy the physical scientists in their terms of their methodology. But it's a very, the methodology of the sciences is very restrictive. It puts you in a straight box. And oftentimes to understand a lot of things, especially in the human experiences, human there. Right now we have had this. I'm in Italy, and the government has just collapsed. And you know, you try to understand the Italian mentality. They've had so many governments in the last 20 years that you would reach already at a level of two governments every 2 years. And you try to understand this and the dynamics of this. And the dynamics of relationships, and science doesn't have answers yet. It's too restrictive. And now I don't know whether that's only a question of the methodology or maybe it's a matter of time. But right now there are many questions which science cannot answer. I'd like to also point out that there are other ways of knowing things that we have developed, humans have developed over time. Many ways of studying academically the human experience, the wealth of human experiences. Unfortunately, many scientists tend to negate those other dimensions of human experience, or other ways of knowing. but they have something to teach us also.
Yeah.
I don't know if I answered your question, Michael, a bit.
That was great. Yeah. Thank you so much.
That does make a lot of sense. And I mean, especially now that, you know, we're in coronavirus times, and any time that you look at the internet or TV or the news or the newspapers, you always hear science says this, science says that, and it's not always the same. And it's interesting to see that now there's a lot of people who say, oh, I believe in this science and I don't believe in this, that I trust science to bring me all of the answers, when I think we can safely say that science has rarely brought all of the answers to everyone, and has rarely been sort of a magic wand that just fixes things.
So just to burden you with a bit more philosophy, there was this movement called the logical positivism in philosophy and in science, basically, it was actually led by the mathematicians of Bertrand Russell would be of the school. And basically what they wanted to do was to prove every mathematical theorem from scratch. You know, there was no assumption. They wanted to prove everything. And they were riding this wave, which was the wave of the success of the mechanical model and the success of the quantum model, right? They were riding that wave. And it was the basic idea was science will be able to solve all problems.
Yeah.
So this is the monastery thing, right? That crashed with the end of the Second World War. Basically, it crashed with the dropping of the bombs in Japan, in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But there was this delusion in the sciences, or this beginning to delude that this bubble would break. So in a sense, in the physical sciences, in physics and chemistry, that bubble crashed then. The biological sciences went on for a couple of years, thinking that they could solve all problems with the genetic, you know, thing. So there are these waves within the science that we can solve all problems with the scientific method. And then we are confronted with the realities, like what we have right, we are undergoing this pandemic right now, and we realize we don't have all the answers. We don't have all the answers yet. Yes, science will give us the vaccines, but the wealth and the complexity of human interactions just makes it impossible to predict everything. And we really don't have all the answers. I mean, I've been reading recently, I've been thinking recently about Silicon Valley and its development of social networks, right? Everyone thought that social networks was a good thing. People had the right to publish. Everyone could be a publisher. It leveled the playing field for everybody. Everyone could be an influencer, you know, a TikTok star, you know, it could be everybody. But they also, the people who created the social web are engineers, right? Yeah. Scientists, engineers, little thinking of the implications of this social network. It has almost led to the crash of democracy, not only in the United States, but even in Europe. And it has led to this abundance of people not believing in the sciences. You know, because now you cannot control the movement. The no-vax people have been the social implications the social implications of social networks is being completely different from what these scientists, these engineers were thinking about when they started designing social networks. And today we are grappling with that question. How do we live in a democracy with social networks? What is the role of it? And it basically tells you that the scientific methods cannot solve all these problems.
Yeah.
And we need other things. We need you know, the juridical frameworks. We need, you know, analysis from social scientists. We need to understand what the philosophers are telling us. We need a very broad education.
And we thought that we like to ask everyone who comes on our podcast the same last question. What are your hopes for the future of your field of research and for the Vatican Observatory? What do you hope will be the biggest things that will come through or that will happen to you guys in the future?
Well, it's difficult to talk about the science, partly because we at the Vatican Observatory, all of us end up doing very different things. So each of us is in a very different field, and not maybe another guy working in galaxies. Most of them are working in stars and planets and meteorites, and one is working in string theory. So it's a whole plethora of things. So it's very difficult as a team to conceptualize one thing. But as for the, I would wish that for the specula to be able to fulfill its mission, to do great science, all of us, to publish real science, to give us that credibility, and to continue in the tradition which the church has always done. But also the other four missions of, you know, helping faithful people who believe in God to understand that science and religion go together. And I think that's the biggest problem at the moment. With the scientists, we are pretty good off because we have very good relationships with scientists. It's a historical relationship which goes back for many years. People know us in the field. If I tell them I come from the Vatican Observatory, most astronomers will never raise an eyebrow because they've already heard about the Vatican Observatory. They know it. They have had friends in it. They've come for our summer schools, and you know they've had conferences here. Our biggest problem is actually dealing with the public, with the people who are not familiar with the scientific world. And I would hope that we would be able to help those people to realize that science and religion together. My hope would be for the observatory to be able to, in this new environment, which is changing in the world today, where this lack of faith in science is growing. My hope is that the observatory can help to do its part for science to regain, you know, that faith which it seems to have lost with the role of social media. I'm hoping that the next time we meet the Pope, we can actually even tell him, we can ask him or request him to write a document, an encyclical, reiterating faith in science, you know, in this very critical period, because right now there are so many people refusing vaccines, so many people, you know, not believing in climate change. It's a chaos, right? And you would think that, you know, this day and age, that science would have more faith, but in reality it's going down. So I'm hoping a lot on that front. We hope to do great research in my field. I hope we can solve some of the big problems we are thinking of solving in the next decades. I really don't know what I would be doing 10 years from now, because whatever problems are there. But at least I'm hoping that in the next 10 years, we don't lose our night sky and that it's polluted with light. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're familiar with what I'm talking about, especially the new satellites coming up. If we can continue to do science, we can continue to gift our children, our next generations, that beauty of the night sky, and be able to them to go wow when they look up and look at the telescopes. And I hope that I will be able to sort out the problem of the satellites of Milky Way mass galaxies at least 10 years from now.
Yeah, awesome. Ben, hopefully all those things happen. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Richard. I think, as you said, I think you beautifully put it by saying, well, not like people are losing faith in science, but I mean, that kind of resonated the entire like essence of our conversation with, you know, faith and science, and how both religion and science, just this idea of that necessity of having faith in both. Thanks again for taking the time to talk to us. And it was a great conversation to have with you. Thank you.
Yes, lovely. Thank you, both of you, for doing this. Take care. And all the best to your team.
Hey everyone, thank you for listening to this podcast episode. This is Michael.
This is Sam.
This is Tommy.
And this is Joe.
If you're listening to this on YouTube, make sure to like, subscribe, and share with your friends. And if you're listening on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, make sure to leave a review. All of the show notes can be found either in the description below or on our website. Thank you again for listening, and we'll see you next week with more Everything Astronomy.